Prepare to be captivated by the business story of the week, hosted by me, Shaheen Shan. Join us on a journey through the twists and turns of entrepreneurial triumphs and setbacks. Immerse yourself in the narrative and witness the magic that turns dreams into reality. This is Business Story of the Week.
And welcome back, folks. Welcome back to Business Story of the Week. I am your host, Joshua, and I'm excited to be here today. And I hope you guys are as well. We have quite a seasoned guest with us. I'm always, you know, you guys know me. I'm always very interested when it comes to guests who are also athletes in their own regard. You know, like, I'm pretty, they do both, right? This brains and the bronze and business, all three B's together. And Simon is quite the example of that. Simon Calver is a seasoned tech executive and investor. He has held leadership roles in companies like Unilever, Pepsi, Dell, before transitioning to tech, where he served as a COO of Riverdeep and CEO of Loveium, which was later acquired by Amazon. Simon has also been involved in venture funding, chairing companies like Moo.com and ChemistDirect.co.uk. He has a track record of successful turnarounds, including Mothercare PTC, and has chaired boards like Fenwick and supported companies like Doctor Care Anywhere through IPOs. I could go on. Like, I'm going to lose breath with all the stuff that Simon has done today. But more than that, he has also rode 3,000 miles in the transatlantic row. We are going to talk about all of that today. Simon, thank you for being on the show. How are you doing?
It's a real pleasure to be here. And thank you very much for the very kind introduction.
I'm excited. I'm excited, Simon, because you have had a long tenure. You have had a massive, you know, storied career, so to speak. But let's start at the beginning of your journey. I always like to start it that way. How did your experience in blue chip companies like Unilever, Pepsi, how did that come about? But more than that, if we go back way back, have you ever known since you were a kid that you were going to be a big tech executive? Tell us about that.
Well, you know, when I was a kid, tech was very, very, very different. I was always interested in technology and computing and programming. And in fact, my degree course was in computer science. So, but it was quite different back then. And actually getting the family business was supermarkets, right? My grandfather was a great entrepreneur. He set them up. He worked in different things. So I was, from my early years, I was involved in stores, in retail, in brands. And I think that just got into the blood. And so when it came to sort of larger companies, you know, the Unilevers, the PepsiCos, et cetera, it just felt like a natural extension of what I've always done. And in many ways, wow, during that time, I parked my tech experience, right? And okay, I carried on, you know, the family DNA. But it was always there, right? The chip was humming. Mm-hmm. And I just came back to it. And, through getting involved in Dell, through getting back to understanding, you know, the sort of the model. But I think my approach is much more tech as a business model and as a model to satisfy customer, yes, and consumer demand and needs, right? Rather than tech for tech's sake, right? I'm not a deep tech programmer, right? But I am someone who thinks about the consumer in every sort of scenario that I've been through.
And I love how you said the chip has always been humming. We could probably say the blue chip has always been humming with all these companies that you've been involved with. How did your approach with leadership and strategy, business strategy? Because you said that you've always been into tech for, not for tech's sake, but tech as a business, as building it up. You transitioned to big blue chip companies into tech startups. Talk to us a bit about that and how much more fulfilling, and why did you transition to something like that?
It's an interesting thought. So what I found from the large companies you talked about, you know, the blue chips, was, you know, how they approached talent, how they approached people, how they approached, you know, performance management and things like that, which, you know, when you're a large organization, you just need to do incredibly well, right? And I think that laid a great foundation for me. I got to understand businesses from a supply chain to a finance and all those other things. And then what I was able to do is almost condense that experience when it came to startups. Yeah. Because, you know, when you do a startup, you've got to do everything. Right. You know, I remember at Love Film in the early days, changing the toilet seat. Right. Because nobody else was going to do it. Right. Oh. So you do. So actually having that broad experience, having that broad exposure to business was great. I find when I moved into the early stage startup world. But it's as much about attitude, I think, as well. It's about being prepared to roll up your sleeves, get involved in things, and actually speak to customers, understand what's going on. And I suppose that's where my early DNA came from.
And that's very interesting how you said, because it does take a different kind of individual. You got to be pretty crazy to get into entrepreneurship, into tech startups. And that is, you know, many of our audiences are like that. And it's always interesting to peer into the minds of how much craziness or how much resilience do you really need, because you talked about rolling up your sleeve and being willing to get into that. Could you talk to us a little bit about your first experiences on tech startups? What were the things that stood up for you, and what were the things that stayed memorable and helped you basically shape the rest of your startup journey up until today?
Right. Well, when I suppose my first Dell was hardly a startup, right? It was a multi-billion organization when I got involved in it. But the pace of decision making I found exciting, right? The adrenaline, you know, that came from that. Then I got involved in a San Francisco based company and moved up to Novato, and it was in the educational technology space, and ran that, and that was fascinating in terms of, you know, you weren't constrained by opportunity, right? You could say, look, if a partnership here is going to work in those areas. And that I found particularly exciting. And I suppose coming from a more commercial, larger company background, I was able to deploy some of that learning through. And again, that pace of decision making. And I think what we all get involved in as early stage entrepreneurs is we love the way, you know, decisions are made. We love the way that we just need to challenge ourselves constantly on thinking about things. And I think that's the discipline that came from some of the larger companies that I was able to put into tech startups.
That's wonderful. Is there a particular startup that stands out?
I think the earliest one where I sort of went in as got involved, you know, chief executive was Love Film in the UK. Precisely. So I ran a business called Video Island, and there were two major players in the UK. The other was Love Film, and one of my VCs, Index Ventures, who I think are one of the best, you know, VCs sort of globally, and Danny Reimer there, introduced me to Reed Hastings at Netflix. So I flew over to the West Coast again, met up with Reed, and I asked Reed to put, you know, we were on our, you know, halfway through our first bottle of wine, and I sort of asked him the question, which is, you know, what are you thinking internationally? What do you want to do? And he said, well, as far as the UK is concerned, maybe I'll wait to see what happens between Love Film and Video Island, and literally on the flight back to the UK, I wrote the business plan to merge our two businesses together. And I went to the board of Love Film, and we ended up merging the businesses to create the ultimate winner in Europe, because we'd merged some. That actually meant over time that we were the main player, right? And we learned a lot from what Netflix were doing. But we also learned a lot to how we approached streaming, how we approached, you know, sort of video, video playback and things. And we built, I think, a really good business. And ultimately, that meant, you know, as part of that agreement, as part of the process we went through, we ended up acquiring Amazon's business. That itself is another long story. And then ultimately, Amazon bought us out in 2011, and we formed a large part of the Prime Video technology you see today.
That is very cool. And I wanted to hear it straight from you and to tell us that story. I understand there were a lot of challenges, right, faced during that period, particularly perhaps navigating the global financial crisis as well, securing investments, dealing with competitions, authorities, including stuff like you've experienced later on, which are navigating mergers. All of this can be complex. How did you weather through all of that? And what lessons have you learned from these experiences?
So I think what was really important for me, running a startup, running a scale-up business is never easy, right? And as a chief executive or a founder, whatever, it's also quite a lonely place to be. Mm-hmm. Right? So the first thing is all about the team you build around you, right? The family. I mean, we became a family at Love Film, and we bickered and argued like a family would argue. I remember one meeting we had where, you know, the chief marketing officer sort of ran out of the room, said, "All right, I've had enough of this discussion," and opened the door and ran out. I shut the door behind him, and then he realized 2 minutes later that he'd walked into a cupboard and shut the door behind him, right? So we were all able to have a laugh about it and move on. But what you have to build is you have to build trust in your team. You have to build trust around you. And actually, where the team's not working, you have to make swift action, right? And you have to take it. You know, people issues don't improve with age, my experience would be. And the earlier you make a move on as someone that's just not working, I think it's better. But you build your own resilience by having the right people around you to help you and advise you in that. And they could be your own executive team, or they could be a board, or they could be actually just a coach or an advisor, right? Which is why I now spend a lot of my time coaching founders and entrepreneurs, just because it's great to be part of that journey as well. But you've got to have a thick skin. You've got to believe in the direction you want to go. You've got to have a single-minded goal that you want to try and achieve. And bring a team with you. While I was at PepsiCo, we had this leadership model, which still sticks with me today, which is the three things a leader needs to do well. They need to do the right thing. Are they identifying what they're doing? Do it the right way. Operate with integrity, belief, you know, and passion. And finally, are you bringing people with you? And what happens, I think, in a startup is that sometimes the pace that you're moving at, you need to bring the rest of the organization and make sure you're achieving the goals by everybody working together.
Simon, I love that. I love how you said, first of all, bringing people with you, but I also like you build resilience with the right people, because if that isn't the sort of recipe to success, you don't succeed on your own, right? Having the right people surrounding you, telling you what you need to hear, not just yes men, you know, these are the makings of great organizations, great teams. And that is because, you know, we enrich each other, we work together, and we uplift what's missing in each other. I love that. Talk to us a little bit about transitioning from operational roles to board positions, because you also mentioned leveraging the board as part of the team members. What do you believe are the key contributions for say someone like a director can bring to the table? That's why you coach them. Maybe you mediate between management, investor boards. How does this process look like, especially when you're coaching executives and corporates like them?
So I think the key thing to think about when you're growing is, what is the right stage to build the talent around the board table as much as it is to around the executive team?
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Right. And what you need to do, what are the skills for success that you need to have as a business, right? At Love Film, for example, we needed to understand how TV channels and stations were thinking about streaming. So we brought a non-exec director in, Dawn Airy, who was really experienced in that area. And she added huge value to us in terms of our future strategy. Right. So you can fill out some of the gaps. I think the relationship that a founder has with the chair of the board is really important, right? In terms of just having that trust and dynamic together, where you can work together on what the issues are. And yes. I've often found that, you know, having an independent person between an investor director roles and between the executive team, right? I think what's really important when you get investors, especially institutional investors, they make their money not when they put money in, but when they take money out. That's how they make their money, right? Yes. As a founder, you get your money when they put money in. Right. So there's often a disparity between how you think about their goal is to get money out eventually. And you've got to work with that. And sometimes that can cause conflict and differences between management teams or founders and between investor directors. And actually having someone independent. I mean, I had a great chairman in Charles Garasa at Love Film. And what he was able to do is sometimes have the difficult conversations for me while I was getting on and running the business. And I think surrounding yourself with people that can help. I mean, George Coelho, Boulderton, ex-Benchmark, you know, a great VC, helped me at times get the VCs around the table aligned behind our exit strategy. So played a role for me, and use people in those roles to help you, because it's very easy to get distracted with lots of ideas of the day that you know can distract you from what you're trying to do. But ultimately, as a founder, you're the person leading the charge. People invested in that business because they invested in you and your executive team, and that's what's really important to remember.
That's such a really key information, right? An independent party sort of mediating, making sure you're on track, you know, between the investor and, you know, between yourself as a founder, making sure everything's running. I think that's such an important detail that I feel like isn't often talked about, right? When it comes to crisis management, though, it's a skill that every leader must master. Where does the independent party come in, if that is required at all? Could you share any specific incident, like the syringe scare at PepsiCo or the challenges you face at Love Film? What are the strategies you employed to navigate through those crises?
I mean we find out really how we are as leaders when we're in the middle of a crisis, not when things are going well, right?
You know,
I think what you need to do is you need to have real clarity and go on the front foot and say, really, what are we trying to achieve? If you don't know all the information, a great example was, you know, if you go back, you know, quite a while now, the Pepsi syringe, when I ran the UK business for Pepsi Cola, What we had to do is we set up a war room. We did the analysis. We ensured our communication was clear. We met daily. Yes. You know, we created a cadence around how we managed the business and we managed the crisis. And we were all consistent in how we communicated. And, it's the same. You know, I remember we changed our business model slightly at Christmas time in Dell. That meant that a lot of deliveries just didn't arrive in time for little Johnny or Katie to have their new laptop under their Christmas tree. And it was a disaster from that point of view. So again, we had to go on the front foot. What do we manage? And my advice always in that one is you have to take the position and view of the customer in those scenarios, right? And make sure that your communication is to them as much as anything else.
And this is, we kind of tie back to what you said, like you do tech startups, not for the sake of tech, but really like building it, right? For the customer, for the consumer, and for it as a business. I think it's particularly very interesting. Do we have a cast, a guest right there?
We do. We have a little furry guest. I'm just going to shut the door. Otherwise, it may...
invite the guest over.
Too much trouble. They'll be louder than me. Right. Okay. So go ahead. Simon, over to you, Joshua.
That's great. You know, I love it. I love all these stories you've been giving us. It's such a great perspective to peer into the experience that you've had, and the way you deliver it is such a simplified manner for all our, you know, startup entrepreneurs. It's just, you know, like taking care of their baby companies and just knowing these knowledge in the long term is something that's quite advantageous. And we really appreciate that, having you on here. Simon, I want to talk about the Atlantic Row. I am very excited about that one for our audience and listeners out there today. The Transatlantic Row is the premier event in ocean rowing. It's a challenge that requires that you will row more than 3,000 miles from West Sebastian in La Gomera, Canary Islands, to Nelson's Dockyard, English Harbor, and Antigua and Barbuda. I love stuff like this. I love big challenges. I could probably never achieve something of that feat. But Simon, talk to us about that. It is fascinating. What were the personal insights and lessons you gained from that experience, and how they've influenced your approach to challenges since then?
I'll tell you what, Joshua, you can do it, right? I reckon you can achieve it. So exactly.
I'm gonna roll with you. I'll only do it with you.
We did a million and a half, you know, strokes on average to get across, right? So it was, so what what was it? So, you know, was it a midlife crisis, right, that a guy in his 50s decided that he wanted to row across the Atlantic? What I found out so much about myself and my personal resilience and how deep you can pull. I mean, at times it was brutal. We were in a 25-foot boat in storms, right? Mm-hmm. And and the nearest person to us at times was 50 miles up in the International Space Station. Oh. Right? There was two of us that did it. And you do 2 hours on and 2 hours off. So you row. Oh. I never slept for more than an hour and 20 minutes for 51 days, right? That's how long it took us to get across. And what did I find, right? The first thing is you have more depth of resilience than you ever believe you have. Yes. Right. And you can call on it. And I've called on it, interestingly, you know, in meetings, in board meetings, in executive situations where you just believe, you know, this is difficult, this is hard, but we can crack it. And there is something unifying and simplifying about having one goal. And our one goal was to get to Antigua safely. And it takes politics out of it. You know, there's times when my rowing partner was struggling or I was struggling, and it just took politics out of it. It took anger out of it, and it gave you real clarity around what you needed to do, whether that be we're going to stop doing this, we're going to re-engineer how we do it, and we're going to, is it going to help us get to Antigua safely, right? And we asked ourselves the question. And at business, sometimes at La Film or Mothercare, whatever, it would be, is this going to move the business forward? Yes or no?
Yes.
And if the answer is no, don't do it, and you focus on it. So that was, I think, one of my key learnings that came out of it, the simplicity and power of a simple goal. The other thing that was really fascinating was the fact that you stay in the present all the time. It's about execution. Wow. Right. Yes, you can overthink strategy, right? It's not about what happened yesterday. It's not about what happened tomorrow. Right. It's about where you are, what you're doing, how hard you're pulling. Are you, you know, is the boat okay? Is the maintenance okay? Have you eaten enough? All those things. And staying in the present means you can be so much more effective. And many times in business, we get distracted by either the past or the future. And if you can combine, you know, what I think is that, you know, amazing sort of synergy around clarity of goal, staying in the present and executing it. And I've seen and helped and talked to people about how to get there. I think you can achieve so much more in business and quicker.
That is, it's just fascinating. It's a fascinating feat. It's a fascinating story. Never slept more than 2 hours for 51 days while you were out at sea. Come on. That's just like, was there a certain point? Because I understand this is a little bit off tangent. I'm still talking about the rowing.
Yeah.
Was there a point where it felt, I understand you start hallucinating if you don't have enough sleep. How do you overcome that? Because you're in the middle of the sea, you're rowing, you're talking, and you have conflict, you have tension with your team, and then you still have to figure out what needs to get done. What was that like? Tell us a bit more, Simon.
Well, you know, hallucinations catch you off guard, and I did. You know, I had some hallucinations where one stage I rode past a major sort of, I don't know, New York hotel, and I wanted to pop in for a coffee, but, you know, but clearly it wasn't there, or reach down for food that's not there. So, but you do that, but actually there is something about, you know, you've got to keep focused on the basics, doing the basics well. You've got to have enough food. You've got to have enough rest. Yes. You can't row for more than 2 hours, because then there isn't enough rest that will enable you to row for 2 hours again. And it's just keeping at it, working through it, and just driving yourself forward is fascinating. And it's the same in business, right? You hit hiccups, you hit storms, you hit issues, and you've just got to, right, what's going to make the difference here? What's going to solve the problem? Get my head down and just work through it with the team that I have. And then when you come through the other side and you get a bit of wind and you get a bit of nice waves behind you, and you suddenly go from 2 knots to 6 knots or 8 knots, and you feel you're like the opening sequence of Hawaii 5-0, right? It feels amazing. But it's a great feeling, and it's a great achievement. But I think to this day, I don't consider that I rode the Atlantic. I feel that I rode for 51 days, right? And, you know, because you're so in the present and you're so thinking about what you're doing. And I think that resilience you learn about yourself is something that you can apply for the rest, you know, through the rest of your life, whether it be business or whether it be, you know, social life, etc.
Yes.
And I think pushing yourself outside your comfort zone, learning about yourself, I think is hugely important for us as founders, because we need to find energy. We need to find passion from anywhere. Right. To just help us drive the business forward. And I think that's it's a really great thing to have done. And it only takes, you know, sort of 2 years worth of training to get there. So you'll be fine.
Yeah. And just 51 days of rowing. You're not biggie. You're not big.
Exactly.
No problem at all. It's just less than 2 months, so to speak. You know, it's not a problem. Simon, it's great because, you know, it's proof that you can go through anything. You can do anything, whatever is challenge. It gives you that sense of strength that no matter where you get into life, you know that, hey, I love that. I love that you said you rowed for 51 days. You didn't row the Atlantic. I think that kind of change and shift and in mindset is like gives you a sense of strength where no matter what challenges you face, that's fine. I rowed it. I rowed for 51 days out to sea. I can do this. And that is same resilience as putting it on business and asking your team to row 1.5 million times together to get through that problem is such a feat, because it's not only done alone, you did it with a team, and that must feel fulfilling. Simon, given your extensive background now in mentoring and coaching, you've been involved in various ventures from after Love Film. How have you applied your learnings to support new IPOs like Dr. Care Anywhere? Through their growth and through their journeys, how have you now applied this? And with your mentoring and your coaching, how does that look like today?
Yeah, so there's two things you've got to get right. You've got to get the business side right, and you've got to get that humming. But you've also got to get yourself right. I mean, think about yourself. You know, the founder is an athlete in their own job, right? They need recovery time. They need space. They need capacity. They need support. Yeah, through it, either on business issues or their own issues. You know, when our own social side of life is not humming or not moving, you know, in the right direction, it impacts the rest of it. So you need to, you know, think about how to work through business issues, and that's where a good, you know, coach or board can help you. But also you've got to think about yourself through that journey as well, and ensure that you give yourself capacity and time. And that's where I spend, you know, an awful lot of my time working with founders and coaches, just helping them on that balance, getting the business strategy right, as well as getting the personal strategy right between them. So that when you get those two together, you know, as I said earlier, use the expression, you've got a real symbiotic, you know, opportunity. Symbiotic. And then that's when you get exponential growth in yourself, in your learning, and ultimately in the business.
And you take people with you, which is the most rewarding part. You take them with you. You take them to success, and they take them with you. They take you with them as much as you do them as well. It's that's a symbiotic relationship right there. It's beautiful. It's quite a journey. It's quite a story to tell to anybody. Simon, as we near this, as we wrap this up, I always ask this question, and I love this. What does the future look like for Simon Calver? What are your future aspirations, and how do you see yourself mentoring, you know, more coaches?
Well, you know, that's a great part of my future. But I think we never stop learning, right? I never stop learning. Every person I coach, every business I get involved with, I learn something else, and then I apply it. I try and process it, and then I try and think, how can I put that back? How can I sort of add that back to my life? You know, I also have, you know, kids that are just turning teens at the moment. They keep me focused, right? And sometimes, you know, a good bit of coaching, not parenting, right, can help them as well. And so, you know, I'm genuinely excited by the future. I'm genuinely excited for what I can do. And as long as I'm continuing to learn and push myself, try new things and challenge new things, I think I'll be happy and live a good full life.
How about another transatlantic row?
I'm done. the oars are hung up, right? Besides which, I don't think my kids would ever speak to me again if I suggested I was going to do that.
Oh my goodness! that does sound like a one and done thing, and it's an impressive feat. As much as impressive as your successes with all these companies and all these extensive experiences in coaching and mentoring that you've done now. And it's an inspiration that someone like you continues to say that we never stop learning. We're always going to grow. We're always going to, you know, take people with us basically along the ride, hopefully. Right, Simon?
Great, of course. Yeah, absolutely.
And again, Simon, I'd like to give this opportunity. Where can we find you? Where can we connect with you? Where can we know the latest with Simon? And please let our audiences know and our listeners as well.
Yeah, well, you can find me on LinkedIn, and you know, I'm deeply involved in that. You can also find me, you know, sort of on online as well, but reach out to, you know, Simon Calver. Calforce is the name of my company, and please feel free to reach out and have conversations. Look forward to speaking to you all, and good luck in your own journeys, right? Be resilient, believe in yourself, and push hard.
I love that. Resilience is something that I have always wanted to work on with myself. It is a continuous process. As much as you have proven and you shared today, Simon, thank you so much for being on the show. Is there anything else you would like to share to the audience to wrap this up?
Well, no, just enjoy it, right? We get one chance at it, right? And push yourself, challenge yourself. I mean, I was fortunate early in my career that I learned many, many different things in large companies and that I was able to apply those. So never stop challenging yourself or learning yourself and reading the, you know, the latest book or, you know, Harvard Business Review or whatever, just to try and get things going. And I think that's, I mean, just business is so exciting, right? When it goes well and works well and you work with a great team.
That's fantastic. Simon, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your wisdom. Thank you so much for being on here on the show.
Pleasure. Real pleasure.
And to all our audience and listeners out there, see you on the next one.
All right. So here's the thing. We try to get a little bit better every day, but we can't do it without you. So if you like the video, make sure to like and subscribe below. And if you have any comments, just leave them in the space under.